the Marquette.
Okay, I think we'll get started. I think people are going to wander in. It's a little bit slow traffic-wise today in Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for coming. In a minute, we're going to have Dave Peckler and Tim Hassel on starting and serving.
How much time do you want?
Hamburger service season, and we're looking forward to hearing about that.
So is mine.
I wrote some stuff down for yourself.
I'll make sure I allocate.
I have a few calendar things to talk about. Before we get started, the March meeting, topic to be announced. We're working on trying to get somebody to come in and talk about dealing with We Energies and other emergency filing issues. So even if you don't have the We Energies issues out in your remote locations or whatever, I know you have emergencies. What are the things you should be thinking about? What do you do differently when it's an emergency filing as opposed to something that you can take more time with? So that's what we are working on. It will not be on March 8th. It will be on March 15th. We're moving the date to the third Tuesday of March. So March 15th, topic to be announced. Watch the biker listserv for and our website for information about that. April, we'll be back on the second Tuesday, that's the 12th. Tentatively, we're going to have Nathan De La Durante and someone from his office on FDCPA claims
with the errors
and bankruptcy. Nathan's been doing a lot of litigation of those, and he's going to share with us the tips and things that you should be looking for.
So you should.
And then I do want to mention that way up in the future, November, the second Tuesday, we're going to have our usual Tom Schreiner, Pete Lane on Supreme Court. Review of what they've done this year, preview of what they're going to be doing. And that is November 8th, the second Tuesday, is Election Day. So we're not going to have Lou Jones on Election Day. We're going to move it tentatively. Today we have to confirm this room, but tentatively the date will be November 1st. And then in December we're back on for ethics on December 13th with Mark Matson and Olivier Ryder. So just keep an eye on the website and your listserv. We want to keep the Lou Jones Breakfast Club going. Thanks today to Judge Hannon, who brought in King Cake. Happy Mardi Gras, happy Fat Tuesday. So we really actually have breakfast today for the Breakfast Club. And thanks to Judge Hannon for doing that. So now, without further ado, Dave and Tim on adversaries. Thank you.
Good morning. I literally just flew in from Madison. Boy, are my arms tired. I know you're out there. I can hear you breathing. All right, enough of that. It really did take a long time to get here. I didn't think I would make it on time. I was staying out on Moreland Road, and traffic is heavy, as I can tell that, because I've been here before, and there's usually more people than this. But today we're going to talk about a scintillating topic, and Tim and I will try to keep you awake, because we're going to talk about starting and serving an adversary proceeding. And as I was preparing this, I always like to think about my subject matter. Those of you who heard me talk about gambling, I went and did a bunch of research on gambling and its history.
Went
and
to
for
the
this,
Potawatomi and
I could have, yeah, but that's too expensive.
So
here I was thinking about it, an adversary proceeding. Why do we do that? And whoever created this must have been looking out. It must have been the gods that look out for bankruptcy lawyers, because thanks to the terminology, we probably keep a lot of other lawyers, normal lawyers, out of our profession. Because terms like adversary proceeding are different, and they scare people. If you don't know about it, then you don't want to do it, usually. At least that's a fairly common reaction. So does anybody here know the difference between a litigator and a bankruptcy lawyer? Bankruptcy lawyers go to court. Litigators do a lot of discovery in this state and around the country, but we actually go to court, and we go to court a lot. So that's the difference. Bankruptcy, and it's sort of designed that way. Because of the nature of a bankruptcy case, being that there's usually few resources, and it isn't necessarily an adversarial relationship. It's more of an administrative negotiation type of proceeding. It has to move quickly. And that's one of the reasons why we do so many things on negative notice, I think. So I was giving some thought to all this. And what I came up with is that I think it makes litigators and other lawyers in general wary of what we do. And probably most of you have had that experience when you deal with lawyers that do family law or general civil litigation. They go, oh, I don't want to touch that bankruptcy stuff. In fact, circuit court judges have that same approach sometimes. When you get into circuit court and the word bankruptcy comes up, they immediately shy away and say, we better go get, you got to get the bankruptcy judge to do something here.
So, too much math.
Yeah. Too much math, maybe. So litigators handle cases, and cases are lawsuits. But for us, cases are not lawsuits. Cases are bankruptcy administration. And litigation isn't a case. We already have the case. Litigation is an adversary proceeding, and sometimes a contested matter, which can confuse normal lawyers even more. So I think that's great. That keeps us employed, and we certainly need to be employed because bankruptcies are down, I think now a little over 50% in the last 4.5 years. So in order to keep you awake today, I have brought a bag of prizes. And fortunately for those of you in the room, those of you on the watching from afar can't participate in the prizes because I intend to hand them out personally. But those of you in the room, your odds of winning a prize have gone way up the fewer the people here, speaking of Potawatomi. litigation in bankruptcy is an adversary proceeding. And that's what we're going to talk about. So what is, and actually before I do that, prize number one. Partake of prize number one, the question to the group is, how many adversary proceedings were filed in the Eastern District of Wisconsin last year, 2015? And I'll take bids from the audience. Closest gets the prize.
112.
112? 210? 211. Oh, he's a gambler. Abe?
I'm 15.
Anybody else want in on this?
No.
209. Well, the answer is 597.
Yeah, much more than that.
So, our first winner today receives a set of Packer 2015 team cards. All right, if that didn't get you awake to listen to the rest of this, nothing will. Okay. So, what is an adversary proceeding? I'll kind of follow the outline, but I'll ad lib a little bit as we go. So an adversary proceeding, all of us know, even though our layman lawyer brethren do not, is that it is a separate civil action inside the bankruptcy case. And that's how I explain it to my clients. I say an adversary proceeding is a separate lawsuit inside the bankruptcy case in which we're going to ask the judge to do blank, whatever it might be. Formally, you'll find adversary proceedings listed, and it's an inclusive list, it's not an exclusive list, so it could be other things, I believe, defined in Bankruptcy Rule 7001, and I've laid all those out on page one of the materials. Down at the bottom, it should say United States Code instead of United States Kide, Side, I don't know what that is. But that is where the law is, down at the bottom. So where do we find the law when we have to look it up, and occasionally we do, when we want to know about adversary proceedings? Well, frankly, it turns out, as I gave it some thought, there's quite a few different sources of where we have to go to fully understand how adversary proceedings work. And, of course, we have Title 11. We all know that. We have 28 U.S.C. 157 and 1334. Those would be the jurisdictional statutes. We have the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure, Part Roman numeral 7. And this confuses our layman lawyer friends as well because they're used to rules of civil procedure, but we use our own set of rules of civil procedure, but most of our rules incorporate the regular rules. So that ought to get their head spinning. And of course, we do have the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure because a number of them, especially in adversary proceedings, apply. Then we have to look at local rules. And the Eastern District, of course, has rules. I think they're the 7000 series there as well. And surprise, surprise, in the Western District, we actually have a rule on adversary proceedings as well. And then the district court You have to look at the law involving district court, because we'll talk a little bit about jurisdiction. I won't bore you a whole lot with Stern and its progeny. It's a little beyond the scope of what we're doing here today. But we do have to look at the district court, because really every adversary proceeding is a proceeding in the district court, which is then referenced and issued to the bankruptcy court. And finally, especially for those of you practicing here in the Eastern District, you need to look at your local judges, each judge's procedures, because they do things slightly different in the way they handle adversary proceedings. So you got quite a bit of different law to look at when we're trying to figure out what has to happen with an adversary proceeding. So the next thing we're going to talk about is what are the types of adversary proceedings. And most of you have probably dealt with some of these, but probably none of us, probably, well, maybe our esteemed judges, but probably the rest of us have not dealt with every one of these. The ones we see all the time, of course, would be proceeding an action to recover money or property. That's a preference. That's a fraudulent transfer recovery. That's a, those would be the two main ones, I would think. But it doesn't include, again, confusing for other lawyers, but if an adversary proceeding is an action to recover money or property, yes, but it doesn't include every action to do so, because a motion for turnover is done by motion. It's not done by adversary proceeding. A request for abandonment is asking for property to be transferred, and it's done by motion. Money, disgorgement of fees by debtor's counsel, is also a contested matter rather than an adversary proceeding. So it all becomes highly confusing, yet we seem to just absorb it by osmosis because we do it. Another form of adversary proceeding, determining the validity, priority, or extent of a lien or an interest in property. The two subtopics there, avoidance of judicial liens and avoidance of security interest in exempt property, we see that a lot, but those are not adversary proceedings. So we don't use an adversary proceeding always to determine these things, only for certain aspects of them. We avoid judicial liens by motion, or we can wait until the case is over and use the Wisconsin statute to right. do it. And then for avoidance of non-purchase money security interest, we do that by motion. So this is why I think non-bankruptcy lawyers get confused about this to our benefit, because we then get to do the work. All right, involuntary sales of interest in co-owned property. That requires an adversary proceeding, and that's because it's co-owned property and we're bringing in a third party. A sale of the debtor's property, in contrast, may be done by motion.
Does anyone know, I mean, where does the line cross, right, between when it is a contested matter to when it's an adversary? I don't know if I'm skipping ahead on you, mm-hmm. but where does the line cross from contested matter to adversary?
Well, I'll answer that.
Okay.
With a summons and complaint.
Okay.
That actually formally starts your process. And the difference is, in a contested matter, we're doing it by motion. We're doing it on usually on negative notice, not always, but very often on negative notice. So an adversary proceeding is a more formal proceeding, and it requires a certain type of service, which Tim will talk about. It requires requires more required elements in our pleading, whether
right.
than what a motion normally would. Doesn't mean that motions don't have certain requirements and maybe certain elements that have to be in there, but in general, adversary proceedings, as we'll see a little later, are more formal and have more requisites. At least that's how I think of it.
Tim, what do you mean by your question?
Well, I think more of my question is, when does it change over from a contested matter to an adversary?
What type of things? Like,
yeah.
What are they trying to get at?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. Half the time I think it's arbitrary.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you take a, not your standard Chapter 13 case, but you take a big Chapter 11 archdiocese, for example, there were a lot of nasty, nasty, big fights, expensive, 20 lawyers in the room on contested matters. It wasn't that it wasn't important, it wasn't, you know, that rights weren't affected. So I almost think it's a little bit arbitrary, and especially this co-owned property one. I mean, you're selling property by a motion that could be very, very valuable. But if the non-filing spouse's property is, you know, proposed to be sold as part of it, you have to use an adversary proceeding. So
right.
I'm not sure why they made this
policy decision to the core. If it more affects the core of the bankruptcy, it seems hard to
stay relief. About how important stay relief is. That's a contested matter.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it's anything but.
Right, because if you look at, to determine the extent of a lien is, but the value of a property is not. I think Rule 3012 allows for valuation to be determined.
That extent of a lien one is tricky because
we're
struggling right now with, we're not struggling, but we're talking right now about should we adopt the proposed national model plan in the Eastern District. That is on the docket for discussion. Anybody who has an idea about it, by the way, is welcome to come to these local rules committees and give us your input on it. But if we did that, then the lien strip adversaries, which who said 100 adversaries? I had 100 lien strip adversaries myself last year. So anyway, lien strip adversaries would be gone. They would be in the plan, and then you would have to serve your plan the way you serve an adversary. So if you were going to strip Wells Fargo's lien, you would have to serve your plan on Wells Fargo by certified mail to the attention of an officer, blah, blah, blah. So,
and service is the same in a contested matter.
Service is the same in a contested matter, but it would be able to be done in the plan. So it's tricky. They do it different all over the country, whether they require, we require an adversary. I'm not sure if they do in the Western District for lien strips.
I use an adversary proceeding because I think there's potential ramifications down the road if you don't. It turns out that you should have.
We've always liked the order that you get with an adversary.
Right. Now you're going to get an order confirming the plan, and you better hope
it identifies what you want.
Yeah, it does what you need it to do. So maybe that's one consideration against having the lien strip be in the plan. But these are the, I do think it's different all over the country. I think other places use the plan, use a motion, and that's the way they do it.
What's the percentage in lien strip adversaries compared to all other adversaries?
The most common by far are lien strips, and we call them David Lang specials, from the old guy from the DWD who used to do these adversaries on overpayment of employment benefits. David Lang is gone, but he lives on in my chambers. It's
Andrew Rubsum now.
Andrew Rubsum now does these adversaries against
non-dischargeability.
A non-dischargeability of somebody who received unemployment benefits that they shouldn't have. I would be willing to guess 80% of our adversaries are of those two ilk.
Okay.
The other 20% is dischargeability, straight dischargeability, when you've got the theft by contractor guy or maybe a fraud claim, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And then real small in some of these other areas.
And it's probably, I didn't actually go and dig that deep in the statistics, but I'm sure they're readily available, because when we get later to actually filing the case, there's a cover sheet, and you have to identify what your cause of action is.
Do you have to do that cover sheet when you file electronically? I think you don't.
I don't think you do.
No.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
That's why I have Tim here.
I don't file it, so I don't know.
Yeah. No, you don't.
But I do need to say, for those of you that know Dave Lang, that the rumors of his demise are exaggerated. He is not gone. He works with my office now.
Oh, does he?
Yes.
Tell him we've
So he hasn't died and passed on.
No, he's just not at the
He's not at DWD
he's not
or
at
DOR.
DW,
no,
yeah.
No. But you're right, Judge. The line between adversaries and contested matters often is very, very blurred. And I'll give you an example. I think it's a case out of the Ninth Circuit that went up to the Ninth Circuit, and it was a motion to reject or assume a lease. I can't remember which one they were trying to do, but the lease was contested. The validity of the lease was contested, and that maybe should have been an adversary proceeding itself, a declaratory judgment as to the validity of the lease.
Right.
And then it went up to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit ruled and said, well, The way that was handled at the bankruptcy court level was the contested matter was handled as expansively as an adversary proceeding would have been, and so even if it would have should have been an adversary proceeding, we're going to uphold this and say that the contested matter was good enough because of the way it was done. So the line becomes very, very blurred at times, and especially when you combine them like this, a contested matter with a defense that perhaps should have been an adversary proceeding.
Right.
So who knows? Questions are welcome. You might get a prize. So there you have.
I would just want to point out, contempt is another one. Contempt is a contested matter, but a lot of people think, I'm trying to get money or property out of this entity that I want to hold in contempt. That sounds like an adversary proceeding, so they file an adversary proceeding, and then the question to the judge is, well, is it okay to use an adversary proceeding when a contested matter would have been good enough? And if you research this area, you'll find there's judges that say, no, you should be using a contested matter. I'm going to elevate, in my opinion, elevate form over substance and say, you come back and file a motion. It can be goofy sometimes.
A list of the contested matters, not all of them, of course, because there's virtually no limit to a contested matter. I'm a firm believer that just because I've never seen a motion doesn't mean I can't make one and ask the court for some kind of relief, and I'm probably going to do it by a contested matter. But there is a list of the more common ones on page 3 of the materials, along with the various bankruptcy rules that you might want to refer to when these come up. I did not put contempt in there, so that's a good one that I should have added. And again, one difference on these, one fairly common difference, not always, is that a lot of our contested matters are resolved on negative notice. And again, that is such an, explaining that to someone who practices just in Wisconsin state court, they're baffled by that. How can this be? How can you get relief just on saying you want it? But it makes so much sense when you think about the scarcity of resources in bankruptcy cases and the need to move quickly because of what we're talking about. So why you as practitioners might want to use adversary proceedings? Sometimes you don't have a choice. Sometimes the bankruptcy court has exclusive jurisdiction, such as dischargeability determinations that you mentioned, Judge, under 523A2, 4, and 6. That's the only place that those can be brought. Sometimes bankruptcy, and I get several matters a year that are referred to me from lawyers litigating in state court who think this might be better in a bankruptcy forum. It could be because bankruptcy judges are perceived to have, and I think in general do have, a better knowledge of commercial transactions of, and it doesn't have to be, commercial transactions scares me because it sounds like the UCC, and we don't deal with the UCC that much, but in general, think of commercial as more just day-to-day economic transactions, and I think bankruptcy judges have a much better handle on that than a lot of state court judges. A general awareness. Debtors' lawyers might want to throw people into bankruptcy and have litigation there for a couple of reasons. One is that I think bankruptcy judges, I don't want to say that you're more sympathetic to debtors. I'm not sure that's true. But I think you have a better awareness of the policies behind Fresh Start and why debtors should get that. And an understanding that exceptions to discharge are strictly construed. It could be ease of service of process compared to
it is. You don't need a process server.
Right?
Right.
And in some cases, not always, but virtually national jurisdiction. We can sue people almost anywhere more easily, perhaps, than a court in Kewaunee County.
Right.
So next I want to talk about pre-filing considerations. As with any lawsuit, you don't just run out and file it. It should require a little bit of thought prior to that. And I want to run through some of the things that I think about before I would file an adversary proceeding. Now, I probably 50-50 defending adversaries and filing adversaries are probably pretty close in my personal practice. So the things that I think about when I'm filing are the same things I need to be thinking about when I'm defending to see if my adversary, my opponent, has thought about all these things.
What type of adversaries have you filed, like, last year? If you can, you know,
Almost everything that's on the list except removal, I think we've done in the last year.
Okay. In the audience, okay. What has anyone filed an adversary besides a lien avoidance in the last year?
Well, somebody.
Yeah? What?
I just filed one with FDCPA claims and breach of contract. I mean, it was like seven things.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
Regarding a debt collector, though?
Regarding a mortgage company that.
Okay.
I did a deed in lieu with my client and then transferred the debt to another mortgage servicer and they're collecting. It's fascinating.
And those are common issues that we would see.
Yeah, lender liability type.
Right.
I would put those in that basket.
Right. You know, violation of a discharge collection practice, you know, after bankruptcy is filed, automatic stay violation, right.
Yeah, there's probably more there than what people think about. And I don't always file. Remember, I'm defending them a lot, too.
Okay.
So preferences, fraudulent transfers, dischargeability determinations.
Yeah, the most common I see is dischargeability, fraudulent transfer, and then I think those are the most common ones.
Well, you do better planning with your clients so you don't get all these preferences and fraudulent transfers.
Yeah, I mean, I see Department of Workforce Development a lot, obviously. And I mean, usually the conversation I have when I see that debt listed is, okay, we're going to get an adversary proceeding. They're going to say that you got this money because of fraud. Did you get this money because you got it when you were working? And we have a discussion before we even file, because I don't know what you're... I mean, we don't represent someone in an adversary proceeding unless there's a separate contract to do so. I don't think that's part of the bundled rights of bankruptcy. But usually we're able to stipulate out. I mean, not, you know, almost 10 times out of 10, our clients will stipulate to non-dischargeability with the Department of Workforce Development. It's pretty common.
And we used to, but now that we've hired Dave Lang, we don't.
Okay.
What kind of defenses has Dave got up his sleeve there, Dave?
I'm not even sure, but we make sure he's cast on it before we just give in on those now.
It's good.
But that's a really interesting concept there. And so I'll throw the question out at those of you in the audience, because my firm, we do very, very few cases on a flat fee basis. So we don't have to worry about that exclusion. We want to do the adversary proceedings. We welcome them. We work on almost always on an hourly fee basis. And so I'm glad to do the adversary. But most practitioners probably, at least in number, work on a flat fee. And then they
right.
usually exclude adversary proceedings. So question number two today. What happens if your fee arrangement does not include representation in an adversary proceeding and your client is sued, your client calls you, what happens? What do you do?
There's like five steps there.
Pardon?
There's like five steps there. We can't just yell out that answer.
All right. Well, somebody has to help me a little bit, though. This is for a prize. I'm ramping this up. This is for a prize.
Let's see the prize before.
The card's worth
it. Yeah. I wanted
the
card.
I don't want to show you ahead of time.
All right. I'll try.
Go ahead.
Let's see. We call client and explain that they've been sued, and that do we know who sued them in this example? Does it matter?
Sure. Go ahead. But whatever you normally do.
Yeah,
you
want to represent the client. So that one's kind of easy. We've already had that conversation. And so it's like, you know, if we want us to stipulate this, I'll just do it. If they want to fight it, then we explain how much that will cost, and then we go back to the first contract and explain the part that they don't remember.
All right, how about if you don't want to represent them? Because there's a lot of lawyers that don't want to do adversary proceedings.
Honestly, it never comes to that because they don't have the money.
Well,
but
you're still going to get a prize.
Assuming I didn't want to represent them and she did have the money, I would explain. Oh, how lovely.
This was donated by the State Bar of Wisconsin. I told her I was speaking here. I said, well, can you give me a prize? And they gave me a coffee mug.
Oh, thank you. But assuming she had the money and she wanted, I guess I would get her over. I would have to file a motion to, what do you call it? get myself out of the withdrawal from the adversary, and I'd help her get a referral.
You are considered the lawyer, just so that you're,
yes.
You're making the point, but you're not saying it. At least in the Eastern District, if you're the attorney for the debtor, you are assumed to be the attorney for the defendant when they're sued in the adversary. You are assumed to be. If that is the way it will set up. When they open their adversary, your name is going to show up as attorney for the defendant, debtor, and you have to get out formally, and it doesn't have to be some 10-page motion. It can be a one-page motion to withdraw as attorney in the adversary. We are not representing the debtor in this adversary, and we would like to withdraw. If the debtor's good with it and cool with it, then do a stipulation that they sign. That's ideal. If they are not cool with it and they think, and I've had these, they think you are representing them in the adversary because that's what they thought they were getting, then you have to give them notice, and if they object, I'll determine it, the judge will determine it, and let you out if that's what you don't want to have a lawyer representing somebody that's not getting paid and not wanting to be there, so it just is a matter of educating that client. Or the third thing could be that you find somebody else to represent him in the adversary, and you would stipulate with that attorney with the consent of that debtor, but you have to do something. You can't just say when the pretrial conference comes along, my contract didn't include adversaries, I'm not going to get on the phone. You have to formally withdraw. That's the rule in the Eastern District. I don't know if it is in the Western.
Not only is that the rule and the way it should be done, but you could get an OLR complaint if you just ignore it, because you are the attorney of record and you probably have a duty to your client either to withdraw. Probably ideally you would call some other lawyer and see if you can get somebody to represent them, refer them to someone. But that's
yeah.
Exactly the answer that won you the cup. Okay. So after you've done your basic factual investigation, the next step is to think about the elements of your cause of action, whatever it might be. And I gave you a couple of examples there in the materials. I'm not going to go through all those. The samples I used were student loans. We all know there's the three-prong test. So you got to make sure you got those elements. So you're going to have all those. And then you also used, Susan mentioned, Judge Kelly mentioned step by contractor.
I used to be Susan to him, so. Okay.
I knew her back when. Judge Kelly mentioned defalcation, theft by contractor. It has its own set of elements. So think about, before you file the adversary proceeding or as you're defending, what are all the elements of this claim, and make sure that they're all present. So after I've thought about my elements, the next thing I move to is my evidence. Because not only do I have to know what the elements are, but I have to know how I'm going to prove each and every one of them, or how I'm going to challenge the proof by the plaintiff's lawyer if I'm actually defending one of these. And again, I gave you a couple of examples that I don't think we'll run through, but I used lien stripping because it's the most common. You probably could think of some other items of evidence there. In fact, even as I look, by property value evidence, there's all kinds of ways to do
right.
that.
What about, Tim, do you run a title search, or how do you figure out who's the mortgage?
I'll pull up on Tapestry with Milwaukee County, the most recent recorded mortgage.
Okay.
And if that does not match, you know, who they received the most recent bill from the servicer,
uh-huh.
then I'll have to look for an assignment of mortgage to figure out how the name on the original mortgage get to the person who has it right now.
Okay.
So, and how does that match the proof of claim if they filed a proof of claim?
Right.
It's been easier more recently. I think paperwork's been cleaned up. I think that was a bigger problem 2 or 3 years ago, but now it hasn't been a problem. Subordination agreements have been filed, and those are easier to find now. So I think a lot of those problems have been cleared up with proper paperwork. I mean, I know you're the only judge who requires testimony by the debtor and affidavit by the debtor as to valuation of the property. So that's something specific to your procedures.
And I don't know if I have it in there about the judge's preferences, but again, know your judge. You can't go wrong with that. I also use some examples from support versus property division, domestic support obligations versus other divorce obligations. We won't go into those. Other pre-filing considerations. You have to know who your parties are, especially when we're talking about lien stripping. That's, and it's not always easy to determine. The same thing is happening with student loans because they too, like the mortgages of old, have been syndicated, and we see these trusts come in. So that's know your parties. Check for prior litigation. Cases can be won or lost depending on what happened in prior litigation in state court. So always check and see if this matter has already been to court somewhere else, because it may either make or break your case depending on what side you're on.
Yeah, I think claim preclusion, right? So if you're bringing it yourself, right, did you list it in Schedule B and exempt it and list it in the plan? Is the trustee aware of it? I had a case recently where a client was in Vegas on vacation, had a slip and fall, and then a Vegas attorney was suing, and there was a big discussion about, did we list this in the bankruptcy? What was the valuation? We did, and that we, you know, I had to basically explain to the local judge in Vegas in a affidavit what the procedures are in Wisconsin, and it worked out. But you know, that was they got a big fight because what's the valuation? Did they properly value it? And do you know?
Right. We're seeing these cases now with these personal injury products liability things where they didn't list them.
Yeah.
And
I've had the
trustees
ones where
are reopening the cases and trying to glom onto the settlements and
the medical malpractice.
Right.
I filled out a questionnaire online 4 years ago. I didn't get any calls, and now I get a call. I've had those as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think in your intake have to be really trying to hone in on those. And just, I mean, if you list it at all, you're so much better off than
right.
Just
and I've changed my
it.
Questions to, you know, any medical claim, if you have anything out there that you filled out, I mean, because I've had that happen twice,
yeah.
They come back 2 or 3 years later. And
right.
Those are big,
six
big
years
settlements.
Later. I have one now, 6 years.
Yeah.
Now the lady's getting money, and the trustee's there with his hand out.
Right.
And his lawyer. I love trustees, but really, 6 years? Come on. Let her have her money.
And that's a good point. That's for a prize. An adversary proceeding may offer advantages if the debtor is a plaintiff in state court. For a prize, what are one or two of the strategies that you might employ that a state court litigator might come to you for about bankruptcy because he's defending a claim by the would-be debtor? So the debtor is presently in state court, it's not a debtor yet. So the plaintiff in state court is suing and they are thinking of moving it to bankruptcy court. Why might they want to do that? I'll give you a hint. The debtor may lose, I'll give you one of them. A debtor may lose incentive to pursue the claim if he knows that the winnings are all going to go to creditors. Loses a lot of incentive to pursue that claim. You can litigate it. So threat of bankruptcy, what we can pose as a threat. How about, I'll throw another one out there. If the claim is not exempt, and it normally wouldn't be if we're talking big litigation, it is far easier to settle with blank than with the debtor.
Trustee.
Who said that? Todd Esser. Abe, all right. Well, Abe, for you, we have... The incredible Legends of Lambeau Collector's Edition bobblehead.
Oh my gosh. Let me see that before you give it to me.
No, I'm so happy to accept this gift because I'm always looking for something to re-gift at Christmas.
I'm sorry, I thought Abe got it. Well, Abe, you'll get another chance. The prizes are dwindling, so we have to move fast.
We have about 15 minutes, so
yep,
maybe
I'm
going to
fly through this now.
Okay.
Consider affirmative defenses. Think about special things that have to be pled, because remember, fraud has to be pled with specificity. Above all, set your client's expectations for litigation. An adversary proceeding is litigation. Litigation is very expensive. Be sure you put it in writing. Have a budget. Have a timeline. Everything should be in writing, always. Anticipate problems. I was going to ask one question about here. I will. I'll give out one more prize here. Statute of limitations, you got to consider those. There are different ones for dischargeability than from revocation of a discharge, and different again for when preferences are received. Think about counterclaims, especially under 523A2. There's a cite there in the material, so since I have to give away the prizes quickly, where else have you seen that citation before? First National Bank of Omaha versus Sisunuvan. Anybody? It happened to have been in our gambling seminar site as well, because that case involved credit cards and gambling. It's
a great case. I've used this. This creditor has a, I've fought a non-dischargeability action twice with this case because, you know, a lot of times a credit card company, I don't know, First National Bank of Omaha in particular, will bring these non-dischargeability actions with doing no pre-filing research. They don't show up to the 341. They don't, no call to the attorney to, you know, why did this person use the credit card for this purpose? And 523D allows for fees on consumer debt if you're successful in discharging the debt. I've gotten two dismissals based upon that because we had a good reason, and then if they proceed, I think you're entitled to the fees because Judge Marty in that specifically said, you know, not showing up to the 341 is a surefire way not to do any research before the action is brought.
Yes, so do your homework before you file. So now you're ready to draft the complaint.
A message that said disconnecting.
I've given at the bottom of page 6, I have, and under page 7, I have a list of what has to go into the complaint, the caption, general rules of pleading. You have to make a designation of the case as core or non-core. You must plead jurisdiction to the court. Jurisdiction, I gave you where to find that on page 6. As with general federal rules of pleading, short and plain statements. A few years ago, there was a little bit of controversy about was the Supreme Court making pleading more strict. You may remember cases like Bell Atlantic back then, but probably not. A short, plain statement of claim seems to still work. Make your demand for relief. If you're asking for attorney fees, the law is, in my opinion, not fully clear, so I think you should plead that as a special claim, a separate claim. I'm not sure if you would require that or not.
If you put it in the wherefore clause.
Always, right?
It in the wherefore clause.
Costs and fees. Yeah.
You get costs if you win, but attorney's fees, you better have a statute to hang your hat on, like this 523D.
Yeah.
But you want to put it in, or you can waive it.
Then you pay your $350, you file the case, and now Tim will tell you how to get it served.
Right. So once you have your complaint served, complaint filed, you'll receive a summons. So that's electronically issued, and along with that, you get a certificate of service. So I got the less exciting part of this, but we're going to go through it nonetheless. So 7004 is what governs service for adversary proceedings. So you can, you know, there's lots of different types of people that you can serve. So, I mean, again, the audience participation. Who have you served, you know, who do you serve the most as far as an adversary in cases that you file?
Mortgagees.
Okay, always, you know, that's the main person. And usually with the mortgagee, it's always going to be a bank. It's pretty rare that you're going to have an individual as a mortgage company. It happens, I've had it happen. It's a little bit different. You have to find an address a little bit different way. I had one recently where the only address I could find was a P.O. box. There was nothing on CCAP. The person wasn't listed. It was only the P.O. box on a mortgage from when they purchased the house originally from the individual, and we had to serve it on the P.O. box. I think you determined that was their place of business. So an individual, and if you look through 7004, you can serve an individual, you can serve an infant or an incompetent person. Anyone ever served an infant or an incompetent person? Okay. Corporation, partnership, United States. Anyone served the United States?
Tricky.
Who? Yeah, I mean, this comes up with lien strips as well.
U.S. Attorney in the district.
Right, HUD, right? You'll file the bankruptcy. All of a sudden, you get a claim from HUD. You have a mortgage on the property that you didn't know about because the person got a mortgage that they haven't been paying. It's just sitting there. But this turns into an action that you didn't anticipate before you filed. Anyone have that happen with HUD? Did you see those HUD claims come in on a second mortgage? But that's one where you would serve the United States, and it's a little bit different as well. So how do you let's go through here. So with a corporation, because I think that's generally who we're going to have, where do you go to find proper service for a corporation? What do you use in the state of Wisconsin?
DFI.
WDFI website. So it's a great tool. A lot of times you're going to get the principal address of the corporation if they registered here in Wisconsin, or you're going to get the registered agent as well. So when you serve a corporation, if you're serving Bank of America, do they have a registered agent in Wisconsin? Their corporate address, you can usually find that online pretty easily. And then what else do you have to serve with the corporation? Who is it sent to at the corporation?
Officer.
Yeah. What a corporate officer, right?
Yeah, president, generally.
Is that who you usually pick?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because you can find them.
They're the easiest person to find, right? They have a CEO, you can go to their website or Wikipedia, or just a lot of times now Google, you can just Google, you know, CEO of Bank of America, and it'll pop up. And that's, you know, you check a couple different places, and, you know, Jamie Dimon, you're sending him.
Jamie Dimon, right?
Right, Jamie Dimon. You know, we all know who, he's the CEO, and is he still the CEO?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if he, yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay.
So when you're serving, so it's sufficient to mail copies of the summons and complaint to that person.
But not if it's Jamie Dimon, because that's a bank, so you
right?
have to do certified mail.
Correct, unless they are FDIC insured. And so that's the next thing, right? So if they're FDIC insured, you have to serve it by registered mail. That's the only difference. And the way to find if someone is FDIC insured is just go to the FDIC website. The link is in here.
Certified mail, right?
Right. By certified mail?
Right. Because I think registered is different.
That's I said, okay. Certified mail. So on subsection X, right? Upon an insured depository institution, right? Service an insured depository institution is accomplished by mailing a copy of the summons and complaint via certified mail addressed to an officer of the institution. And on the last page there, you'll see subsection B. There's the website you can use to see if someone is a depository institution. Service by publication, not that common. In fact, I've never done that. I've usually been able to find the person and the individual, especially because you don't have to serve it on someone. Serving by mail is sufficient. And I think the last, you know, so we have a exhibit here that we were going to go through and kind of goes through a complaint of what we would file. Okay, and there's some errors here. It's the first exhibit. Does anyone see? So the first page, there's one right off the bat. What is a possible issue with the service? Does everyone have a complaint? So is MERS?
Is MERS someone that defendant?
Right.
Yeah.
That's the first issue. Probably not. MERS is not someone that would hold a complaint. They're recording. They record where it is, but MERS is not an actual possessor of the mortgage. Note. So that's the first issue. I think that's the only issue on the.
Well, other people might find something. What's interesting about our captions in adversary proceedings, unlike state court, is we have two case numbers.
Right.
We have the bankruptcy case in chief number, and then we have the adversary proceeding number. And we also have two case names, which is why when we're looking at citations, sometimes it'll say, in this instance, In Re Jane Homeowner, and then Homeowner versus MERS. So again, points out the distinctions between how we work and how regular lawyers work.
On the second page, it goes through factual allegations, right? So the homeowner owns this piece of property located this address. Right? The value of the subject property is $145,000. This is according to a 2011 market analysis by this appraisal group.
And so the lawsuit's filed in 2016, you can tell from the case number.
Right. So the issue with that is, this is an old market analysis. When you file an adversary, particularly a lien strip to prove valuation, does anyone here get an actual appraisal? Okay.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Does anyone just get a market analysis? Okay. I just get a market analysis. That's cheaper. I would get an appraisal if it was contested. But most of the time, I get the just a market analysis, because a lot of these times, these houses are so upside down, particularly with the 2008 mortgage crisis, that usually the bank doesn't respond. A lot of these are default judgments. So I think that save $300 for the debtor. And they, if they're already in an upside down mortgage, they don't usually have $300 that they want to waste on an appraisal. So that's the first issue, right? Do we have good evidence? So that's not good evidence. You would have to get an update to that. What's the value now? Especially, housing prices have gone up a little bit. So that's something that's changing. So the number 11, right? MERS holds a second mortgage. Well, MERS probably does not have a second mortgage. And they haven't filed a claim, so MERS won't be filing a claim, but the claim is going to provide you information of who has the claim now or who believes they have the claim now and where they can be served. Defendant MERS.
Now that secured creditors have to file claims, according to the Seventh Circuit, this might make it easier for you guys.
It might, but if it's also a second mortgage, which they don't care about,
then they're not
going to
file.
They're not going to.
Okay.
And we get the trustee after the 341 is looking for us to file an adversary, and usually you're trying to get this case to confirmation. You don't want to wait that 120 days to get a claim in that may or may not come.
And the case the judge is referring to, Pajan, is that
P-A-J-I-N,
came down around August or September, I think.
Right. Defendant MERS is lien is subordinate to $145,000 first mortgage, lien held by Honest Mortgage Company. Honest Mortgage Company has not filed a proof of claim on the senior mortgage debt as of the date of filing. The amount listed is based on the plaintiff's best guess. So whenever I file one of these, I'm always getting the most recent mortgage statement if they have it, and usually they do, and that's going to give me the best evidence if a claim's not filed, what is owed on the first mortgage. Other than that, the claim is always the best evidence for what is currently owed. This also comes with the subordination agreement. You got to look at the recording numbers, because I would say at least 10% to 20% of the time you're looking at those recording dates, and the second mortgage is going to be recorded before the first mortgage, and then you have to start looking for a subordination agreement.
One other thing when you're talking about the valuation that I learned a long, long time ago, and it's served me well many times, is that remember that the owner of property is always competent to testify as to its value. Now, the weight of that testimony may not be much, but you can at least get evidence in as to value, even if you don't have anything else, as long as you have the owner. So that's a good little tip. And we're almost out of time. I'll give you one last question. I'm gonna tell you about a case that we had with Judge Martin. So it's a Western District case, so you're at a disadvantage. So I will say me, I'll claim that I'm the lawyer, I wasn't. But so I knew I was filing this adversary proceeding. I contacted, this happens to be an Eastern District lawyer, by the way. I contacted the Bankruptcy Court for the Western District of Wisconsin to confirm that I would be allowed to file an adversary as an initial pleading via the ECF system. I was asked if I had an ECF login and password. I indicated that I did. And then they told me what documents I needed to file. I attempted to log in to the ECF. I discovered my login and password did not work. Through additional inquiries, I learned that there is one admission password for the East and one for the West, and that's why I couldn't get into the system and file it. My office is located in downtown Milwaukee. At the time I learned that I would be unable to file the adversary through ECF, it was too late in the day to hand deliver it to Madison prior to the court's closing. I asked if there was a Dropbox where I could file it later that night, but there isn't. In an effort to satisfy the filing deadline, because this is the last day to file, I sent physical copies of the adversary complaint and all the necessary documents to the bankruptcy court via FedEx, which picked up the documents at 7 p.m., 5 hours before my deadline, and they were received at the bankruptcy court the next morning at 9:49. So those are the facts. That last day to file, was told you can file by ECF, then learned that the ECF required a different password than what I had. What do you think Judge Martin did? Did he dismiss the complaint? or use equitable powers and allow the complaint to stand and be heard. Come on, you got a 50-50 chance at this.
Unless he's changed a lot, he's dismissed the complaint.
I think you dismissed it.
You can't.
Anybody want to go the other way?
Well, I don't think you would accept it. If you can file it by mail, then posting it should constitute filing.
All right. Well, the prize, and since Todd was doing this, the prize for this one, Judge Martin threw it out.
Yeah.
And we have the last prize of the day, collectible glasses, brewer shot glasses. Ooh. Who better than Tom?
I have a friend in Madison. And
I'll get a lot of
email it to him. That's the solution.
Right, right.
Could you
yeah, you got to have
to get in there.
Can't.
On the day.
There's no mailbox rule.
We have a question, Judge. What would happen if
should he have filed it in the Eastern District and then said, oops?
How could you, though? I mean, the case is pending in the Western.
Oh, right.
I don't know how you could. I mean,
yeah, you're right.
Before we had this wonderful thing called UCL back in the Stone Ages, people with deadlines like this, they would literally hand deliver to the clerk's house or the judge's house. I mean, if you have to, you have to. The court is always open. That's a rule. So, I mean, ECF now makes it so easy we don't have to do that. But if you were in that situation, you would call the supervisor's emergency telephone number and say, where do you live? I'm coming to your house with this complaint. And they would have to take it. So that's unfortunate. I want to commend the outline to you. It's got the websites that they talked about. It's got some great information that we didn't have time to go through. I want to thank Dave and Tim for putting this together. Stay tuned to the Biker Listserv for info about next month. I know we're going to be on March 15th, and we're working on a really timely topic for you, so I hope you'll all come back for that. Thanks for coming. Have some king cake on your way out.
Thank you.
Nice job, Tim.